You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
We use civil disobedience to challenge Israel's policy of collective punishment against the Palestinian people, but Israel remains central, and therefore we need to continue using this kind of civil disobedience and others, and also explore political and legal tactics to challenge Israel's continued punishment.
The media has left. The crowds have dispersed, but the dire economic and humanitarian situation still remains in Gaza. Crossing the Line speaks with Huwaida Araf, a Palestinian-American activist and co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, about the group's return to the region and how the siege of Gaza will be broken again. Also this week,
Following the UN definition on the Convention of the Rights of the Child, a child is defined as someone under the age of 18. But this is an important point because under Israeli military law, which applies in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, children are actually defined differently from Israeli children. Palestinian children are defined differently from Israeli children. So if you're a Palestinian and you're aged 15, 16, 17, you're actually considered as an adult under Israeli military law in terms of sentencing and the way you're actually treated in prison.
11,000 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli jails at any one time, including as many as 350 children under the age of 18. Author Adam Hania talks with Jane Williams of the Red Eye Collective about why there are so many Palestinian prisoners and the consequences for families and society in general in the West Bank and Gaza. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for October 11th through 17th, 2008. Israeli military and settlers stepped up attacks in the West Bank, killing three Palestinians and detaining dozens. Meanwhile, talks between the rival Palestinian factions continue in Cairo in bid to reach national unity agreement. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with nonviolent actions in the West Bank, where Israel continue to confiscate more land to build the separation wall and settlements. Six human rights activists were detained in a protest against attempts by Israeli settlers to take over the site of a former Israeli army base in Beit Sahur on Thursday. A number of internationals and Palestinians from the Bethlehem area staged a demonstration on the site located in eastern Beit Sahur near Bethlehem as hundreds of Jewish settlers flocked into the area and erected structures. The settlers claimed their actions were to celebrate the Jewish festival of Sukkot. The international human rights activists, along with local residents, including a number of children, were at the site from the morning, picnicking and bird-watching with the Wildlife Society and the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. The center is a local organization in Beit Sahur, which regularly organizes activities on the site since it was evacuated by the Israeli military, who had used it as a military base for 39 years. Israeli troops tried to force all the Palestinians and internationals to leave the site when the extremists settlers arrived. The settlers have organized a number of activities in the area since last May in an attempt to build another illegal Israeli settlement on the 25-acre hilltop. As the crowd of internationals and Palestinians started to leave following threats by an Israeli armed settler, Israeli troops assaulted and detained six of them. Sami Awad of Bethlehem was among those detained.
Of course, we did not engage in any violence, even in our language. We were very peaceful with them and to them. But the settlers themselves began provoking and threatening. One settler pulled out a machine gun and pointed it towards us and used very threatening and foul language towards us. The army and police asked us to move back, even though we were in an area that was not declared as a closed military area by them. And as we were beginning to actually move back from that area, the army and the police attacked us physically. They were very violent. Even while they were arresting us, they were beating us up, throwing us to the ground and stepping on us.
Also in Bethlehem, Israeli troops on Friday obstructed hundreds of Palestinian farmers accompanied by internationals who were trying to harvest olives on land where Israel is building the wall in Al-Masara and Salamona villages southeast of Bethlehem. The farmers and their international supporters started the harvest in the early morning, but when they tried to reach the area adjacent to the construction site of the wall, troops assaulted them and attempted to stop them. Meanwhile, a number of Israeli settlers gathered on an adjacent hilltop, shouting racist slogans like "Death to Arabs" and "Get the Arabs out so that Israel will be clean." In Ramallah, the residents of Belayin continued to organize their weekly nonviolent protests against the wall and settlements. On Friday, hundreds of villagers, accompanied by international and Israeli peace and human rights activists, marched through the village carrying Palestinian flags and chanting slogans against the wall that is grabbing wide areas of the village's land. French and Norwegian solidarity groups also joined the Belayiners in their demonstration demanding Israel allow the Palestinians to harvest their olives. The protesters were opposed by a number of Israeli soldiers as they made their way to the lands besieged behind the wall. Troops showered them with tear gas, rubber-coated steel bullets, and concussion grenades. But the protesters managed to walk through and break the gate. Dozens were exposed to the gas and received medical treatment at the scene. For IMEMC, this is George Shmawi. The rival Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, continue to hold talks with Egyptian officials in Cairo in a bid to end their 16-month division. More with IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas rejected holding direct bilateral talks with the rival Hamas party in Gaza, arguing that representatives of other Palestinian factions should be present in any talks. Hamas regarded Abbas's rejection as a slam to underway Egyptian mediation efforts, saying this would hinder national unity talks. Hamas's exiled political leader Khaled Mashal called for ending political arrests in both Gaza and the West Bank to guarantee success of current reconciliation talks. From Cairo, officials are ready to invite other Palestinian independent public figures such as religious scholars and local community leaders to the dialogue in order to help convince parties concerned of the significance of a peace deal. Fatah and Hamas have been at loggerheads since Hamas took power after January of 2006 parliamentary elections. In February of 2007, they formed the first ever national unity government. But 4 months later, fighting broke out, ending with Hamas taking over Gaza and Fatah forming its own government in the West Bank. In another news, a Saudi Arabian local newspaper, Okaz, reported this week that Israel agreed to comply with the Hamas party demands regarding a prisoner swap for the release of captured Israeli soldier in Gaza, Gilad Shalit, and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners currently in Israeli jails. Israeli official sources denied such a report. For the past several months, Cairo has been mediating a prisoner swap, yet Israel refuses to release hundreds of Hamas's list in exchange for Shalit. In Gaza, spokesman of the Islamic Jihad group Sarai al-Qadr Brigade, Abu Ahmad, said his faction reserves the right to terminate current truce ceasefire with Israel due to what he called Israel's procrastination to lift the Gaza blockade. However, the spokesman confirmed that his group awaits a factional consensus on the matter. According to the local committee for breaking the Israeli blockade on Gaza, Israeli authorities have only permitted one-third of goods and necessary items for Gaza into the Gaza Strip since June of this year. Also, the committee says the Gaza crossings remain closed. 4 months ago, Israel and the ruling Hamas party agreed to an Egyptian-mediated peace talks, stipulating the end of homemade shells fired from Gaza into Israel and lift of Israel's debilitating blockade on the coastal territory since Hamas took it over in June of 2007. At the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks level, both Palestinians and Israelis have yet to see the vision of U.S. President George W. Bush towards a two-state solution come true. This week, in a meeting with investors in Washington, the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called for much more concentrated effort to achieve the vision before the end of Bush's term in January 2009. On another note, Member states of the International Parliamentary Union in Geneva, excluding Israel, voted unanimously this week for accepting Palestine as permanent member state. The decision is the first ever by an international organization since Israel occupied Palestine in 1948.
Israeli military and armed settlers' attacks on Palestinians were observed widely throughout the West Bank this week. The details with IMEMC's Jessica Husley in Bethlehem.
In the West Bank city of Hebron, the settlers attacked a Palestinian neighborhood. No casualties were reported. Also in the West Bank city of Beit Sahor, the settlers attacked a neighborhood in the presence of Israeli soldiers. Six people were detained by Israeli military. As part of these attacks, witnesses in the city of Ramallah believe that a teen Palestinian boy was killed by settlers on a road near the Israeli settlement of Beit El on the outskirts of the Jalazun refugee camp. This week, the Israeli military killed three Palestinians and wounded at least two others in the West Bank city of Ramallah. Also, in the West Bank city of Nablus, Israeli soldiers shot and wounded a Palestinian man while attempting to cross the Israeli-controlled checkpoint of Hawara due to prolonged hours of no movement. In addition, this week, the Israeli military detained at least 20 Palestinian residents from the various West Bank areas as an Israeli military court sentenced five residents and demanded the detention of two others. Dr. Mustafa Al-Burguthi, chairman of the Palestinian Initiative Party and former information minister, described the Israeli actions across the West Bank as an indication of Israel's drive to weaken the steadfastness of the Palestinian people. Al-Burguthi also believed that these actions will lead to a third Palestinian popular uprising in the face of the Israeli occupation. For IMEMC, this is Jessica Holsey.
Israeli military attacks on the Gaza Strip continued this week, with Israeli naval vessels firing at Palestinian fishing boats throughout the week. Also, the Hamas-led police forces rounded up a number of local journalists. IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza has more.
Israeli naval forces were reportedly fired at Gaza fishermen on boats on Gaza coast in different parts of the coastal territory. Such Israeli attacks take place in the prisons of members of the international peace activists. No casualties were reported in these assaults, yet media reports said that the Palestinian fishermen were repeatedly asked by the Israeli vessels to stay away from the shores, an order that is inconsistent with the previously signed peace agreements allowing fishermen to go more than 12 nautical miles inside the Gaza shores. In addition, according to the International Solidarity Movement, a grassroots international organization dedicated to the solidarity with the Palestinian people, the Israeli soldiers controlling the Gaza-Israel border eastern border lines shoot at Palestinian farmers while in farmlands close to what Israel calls a buffer zone. Members of the Gaza-based ISM helped this week harvest olive trees on the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip in an attempt to protect those farmers from Israeli army fire at this particular season, where olive constitutes a major source of income for the besieged strip. In the meantime, the Israeli authorities in northern Gaza denied access of an Israeli Arab medical staff into Gaza for conducting major surgical operations for the besieged patients. Jamal al-Khudri, a lawmaker and a chairman of the local popular committee for breaking the Israeli siege on Gaza, announced on Thursday that the death toll of patients awaiting a treatment outside of Gaza reached 252, with the death of a Gaza patient boy this week. On the internal level, the Hamas-led police forces in Gaza rounded up at least five journalists and a researcher in the central Gaza Strip city of Deir al-Balah and in Gaza City. No further details were given by the Hamas's interior ministry. Since June 2007, the Israeli occupation authorities have been enforcing a crippling blockade on the Gaza Strip, preventing smooth access of peoples and goods in and out of this strip home to 1.5 million residents. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
And that was just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant update, check our website www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and George Shmawi. Goodbye.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On Sunday, October 15th, Israeli naval ships fired machine guns at Palestinian fishing boats operating within Gaza's supposedly protected sea space. The naval ships fired after circling the fleet of small fishing boats and demanding that they return to shore. Under international law and signed agreements between Israelis and Palestinians, Palestinian fishermen in Gaza are supposed to be able to fish in a restricted area off the Gaza coast. But in the last year, Israeli naval forces have prevented them from fishing at all, which has had a devastating impact on the Gazan economy. The report came from the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, a Palestinian-led grassroots nonviolent movement that includes international nonviolent activists stationed in Gaza. Over the last 2 months, the ISM has reported numerous incidents of Israeli naval ships firing at Palestinian fishermen. On August 29th of this year, the ISM broke the siege on Gaza when two ships, the SS Free Gaza and the SS Liberty, sailed into a Gaza port. At the time, there was great concern that such an attempt to break the siege might be thwarted by the Israeli military, who threatened to use force in order to prevent the ships from entering the region's territory. However, due to activists, government officials worldwide, and extensive media coverage, the military allowed the boats to enter Gaza waters. Since that time, the ISM has begun maintaining a presence in Gaza in order to document human rights abuses, accompany fishermen, and be a witness to the ongoing suffering of the coastal region's 1.4 million residents. With us to talk more about the ISM's return to Gaza is Crossing the Line's good friend Hawada Araf, a Palestinian-American lawyer, co-founder of the ISM, and currently a resident of Israel. In addition, she was one of the coordinators and a participant of the Breaking the Seas action. Hawada, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you for having me.
Hawada, can you talk about the decision for ISM to return to Gaza? Was this made when you all landed in the port on August 29th, or had it been something that had been brewing for some time?
Well, ever since not only the ISM, but international observers in general were banned from Gaza in 2003, we've been thinking about and exploring ways to get back. And we've had a very small number of activists that have been able to get in. But other than that, Israel has kept a very tight closure. There is and it's made the process of getting into Gaza more complicated, not only for human rights observers, but even for official UN bodies. They have had difficulties often getting food and other supplies in, yet continue to deal with the Israeli authorities in this way, because really there's no other way. You mentioned that we were able to break the siege, but technically speaking, it's not really a siege that's on Gaza, but it is a form of collective punishment that the Israeli military and government is imposing on a people that it occupies. Israel tries to rid itself of this obligation. Israel is an occupying power, and therefore the welfare of the people inside the Gaza Strip are the responsibility of Israel. The welfare is the responsibility of Israel, but again, Israel tries to shirk this responsibility and claim actually itself that it is using legitimate military tactics against a hostile entity. And we must always be careful to assert and to remind the international community that Israel still is an occupying power. When the boats came through, what we were actually doing, it was organized not by the ISM, but certainly a lot of ISM activists were involved in the body that actually did organize it, activists around the world under the name of the Free Gaza Movement. What we actually decided to do is challenge Israel's policies on Gaza, challenge the fact that Israel does have control of Gaza and has so grossly abused its power that something needed to be done. And therefore, it wasn't necessarily us saying that, you know, we've broken something, we've broken the siege, Gaza is free now. No, Israel still, even if it let us pass, and you actually mentioned that Israel decided to let the boats pass because of probably the level of our organization and the fact that we did have so many international activists around the world, not only the 43 of us that were on the boats, but around the world that supported us, and the media was also with us. And we've also had the cooperation of governments that did not bend to Israeli pressure to try to stop us from leaving. So Israel decided it would be less costly for them to let us pass. So this is also recognizing that we use civil disobedience to challenge Israel's policy of collective punishment against the Palestinian people, but Israel remains in control, and therefore we need to continue using this kind of civil disobedience and others, and also explore political and and legal tactics to challenge Israel's continued punishment of the Palestinian people. And so, to go back to your question, we've been looking for years, we've been trying to see how we can get a presence back in. And what the Free Gaza movement did was one of the ways. Honestly, those of us that were on the boat didn't even expect to get in. What we wanted to do was draw the attention of the international community to what was happening and let the people of Gaza know that they weren't alone. We are definitely trying to do something. But the pressure did cause Israel to cave at this point. The activists were allowed to enter and are there right now. But again, it's a very small amount, and it's important that we don't stop challenging this policy and trying to get in.
Hawaita, you mentioned that the Israeli government is pretty much just allowing this to happen. As you said, that you all were surprised that you were able to get in. I'm curious, when Jeff Halper, who was one of the participants, who is a well-known Israeli activist who has continually fought against the apartheid system of the Israeli government, got back to Israel, he was immediately arrested. My question to you is, were there any repercussions for yourself when you returned to Israel because you are a citizen? And also, what might be the difficulties, in your opinion, that you can foresee to those who are internationals who have been to Gaza in trying to get back to Palestine in order to do other work within the West Bank?
Well, the difference between Jeff and I is that Jeff decided to go back to exit Gaza through the Erez land border crossing with Israel. And therefore, he went right up to them and he said, I'm leaving Gaza and I'm going home. And therefore, they arrested him and he had a hearing and the government wants to charge him. They ended up letting him go in the meantime, but they declared their readiness, actually their intention to charge him with being in Gaza. Israeli citizens are not allowed to actually even be in Palestinian areas. It is considered an offense. It's against the Israeli laws, of course, unless you're a settler, and then the government protects you to steal Palestinian land and establish a colony there. But otherwise, Israeli citizens that want to go visit Palestinians, that want to see actually what life is like, that want to stand in solidarity with Palestinians, they can be arrested and prosecuted, and that's probably what they'll, or that's what they said that they're going to charge Jeff with when they actually do bring him to trial. I left Gaza the same way that we came in, via the boats, went back to Cyprus, and then took in, flew back into Israel, and that, you know, I was ready for them to arrest me and do the same as they did to Jeff, or even worse, but they didn't. Why they didn't, I'm not quite sure. Perhaps, quite likely, because I wasn't as high profile as Jeff as far as the Israel is concerned. The Israeli media really focused on him. He's Jewish. I'm not. This, unfortunately, is a big factor when it comes to Israel and the psyche of the Israelis and what they care about and what they don't care about. That could be the reason. There could be other reasons. I'm just glad I wasn't arrested, and I'm going to keep doing what I can until time, that time that they decide to arrest me or do something more, and then we go into a different fight. As far as the other internationals that are in Gaza right now, it is very likely that they won't be able to get back into Palestine anytime soon. As you know, and as many of your listeners know, Israel for a very long time has been, anyone that it suspects of being sympathetic to Palestinians and solidarity with Palestinians, it denies them entry into the occupied Palestinian territories. And I say it denies them entry into the occupied Palestinian territories because you know that Israel controls all entrances and exits, and so it, even if internationals only want to go to the occupied territories and not spend any time in Israel at all, Israel still has a say on who gets in and who gets out, and many people have been banned, and that's what I expect of the people that are in Gaza right now. As far as I'm concerned, how they deal with me, because as you mentioned, I am an Israeli citizen, they can't bar me from entering. They give me a very hard time entering and exiting, sometimes interrogation or hours of searches. But in the end, unless they decide to pull my citizenship from me, which is also a very, it's very possible, because less than 2 months ago, the Israeli legislature, the Knesset, passed a law that allows them to pull the citizenship of people that they expect are or suspect are working against the state. And of course, for Palestinian citizens of Israel, the you know, what can be counted as working against the state or hostile against the state is you know, is subject to what the Israeli security services said, and it's hardly ever challenged anyway significantly by the Israeli courts. So that was a concern of mine, that they will end up trying to pull my citizenship, which means that they could also deny me the right to go back to my homeland. But, you know, I took that chance, and as of yet, they haven't done it. So we'll see.
I can recall back in March of 2003 when Rachel Corrie was killed, as well as Tom Herndahl was killed roughly a month after she was. And not too long after those two had died, a man named James Miller, a British cameraman, was shot and killed in Gaza. There has been no repercussions for the Israelis in regards to these murders. Is there a concern that those who are currently in Gaza right now, who are accompanying fishermen on their boats, might unfortunately be the product of another Israeli assassination and therefore not have any kind of active jurisprudence to bring about those who perpetrated the crime to justice? I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel that those who are there now might be in danger since Israel has really ramped up its aggression towards Gazans, whether they be Palestinians or internationals?
Yeah, that concern is always there. This is something that the Palestinian people face every day, and that the internationals that have decided to be there in solidarity, whether it be in the West Bank or in Gaza, have decided that they are, you know, they know that they are taking that chance. They also know that despite the fact that Israel has used more violence against internationals and has not faced any repercussions, has not been held accountable for the deaths of these unarmed civilians, that it still remains more costly, let's say, for Israel to injure or kill an international civilian. Because although no one has held Israel accountable, the world does pay more attention because Palestinians have been so dehumanized, certainly in the eyes of Israel, but even in the eyes of the international community, it's almost just numbers now. I mean, in the past 8 years, over 5,000 people killed, many of them children, women, and no one has held Israel accountable. These are challenges that are faced and dangers that are faced by Palestinians every day, and internationals that are there say that we are going to stand there in solidarity, knowing full well that there's also a risk to their lives. They're not immune to this violence. It's very hard, actually, with the kind of very violent force that Israel uses and the discriminate way that it attacks unarmed civilians, that anyone that is there really has their life in danger. Whether Israel will decide to purposely kill an international to scare off the internationals that are there right now, that's kind of hard to say, and that's what they might have been doing back, or what they might have done in 2003, because the internationals that were standing in solidarity with Palestinians and that were present and that were reporting on what was happening, including Rachel Corrie, were becoming a pain to Israel, and they had tried so many tactics before to try to get rid of the international solidarity movement, whether it was kind of vilifying the people, trying to accuse them of being terrorists, arresting and deporting them, beating them, injuring them, and then it came to killing them. You know, we haven't really said it was purposeful. The fact that no one was held accountable did give kind of a green light, and that possibility is really there, which is why, you know, those of us that aren't there and those of us campaigning all around the world really need to keep the pressure up and constantly look for ways to challenge what Israel is doing, obviously not just for the internationals there, for all of the civilians there that, you know, that have their lives so easily disrespected and can be so easily disposed of. It's really a dehumanizing feeling. The fact that internationals are there with Palestinians saying that we're trying to do something about it helps raise morale a little bit, but we really need to be doing a lot more.
And finally, the cameras have been put away, all of the fanfare and coverage that you all have received while you're en route to Gaza. has all left. I know that you all are planning more boat trips to Gaza in order to, quote-unquote, keep breaking this siege. If people want to know more about this whole event, where can they go and how can they go about finding out if they can be involved in further direct actions?
Well, the easiest way is via our website, which is www.freegaza.org. And as you mentioned, we are planning to go back, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. So I hope you will stay tuned, stay with us. And the like we had mentioned earlier in the show, Israel had the decision, it could have stopped us. It made the decision to let us go through. It declared after that it was a one-time thing, but we are going to keep challenging it. We're going to go back with the same level of, organization and under the same principles that we went the first time, and to see what Israel does. And the second time, a third time, it's important to keep challenging this. And if people that are listening want the support, and we really couldn't have done it without the support of not just the people on the boat, but people all over the world, whether they helped us with media, whether they helped us in organizing local events, whether they donated money, supported someone to come, or whether they were on the boats themselves. It really is a collective effort of people in so many different countries to really make it happen, and we need to make it happen again. So check out our website, and there's contact information on there. Again, it's www.freegaza.org.
And we are going to leave it there, but we will continue to follow the story. We've been speaking to Hoada Araf, a Palestinian-American lawyer and a citizen of Israel and co-founder of ISM. And if you're wanting to know more information about future Breaking the Siege actions, you can go to www.freegaza.org or check out our link section where you'll find it there. Hoada Araf, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Nathan.
The number of prisoners in a country, their ethnicity and their age, are markers of the character of the society that imprisons them. The hugely disproportionate number of indigenous people in Canada's jails speaks loudly to our discriminatory structures, as does the hugely disproportionate number of blacks in the U.S. prison system. And Palestinians are the largest population of prisoners in Israel. To explore the situation of Palestinians in Israeli prisons, we're joined by Adam Hania. He is co-author of the book Stolen Youth, The Politics of Israel's Detention of Palestinian Children. He's also an activist with the Campaign Against Israeli Apartheid. And we've reached Adam Hania in Toronto. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Jane.
How many Palestinian prisoners of all ages are there in Israeli jails?
Currently, there are about 11,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons and detention centers. These are Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, living under Israeli military occupation, most of them from the West Bank. This number is not a new figure. It's basically been at that level or greater since the occupation began in 1967 of those two areas. So around 11,000 currently in prison, ranging in age from 12 upwards, and there are around 350 Palestinian children included in that figure in Israeli prisons.
When you say children, what do you mean by that? What age?
Following the UN definition on the Convention of the Rights of the Child, a child is defined as someone under the age of 18. But this is an important point because under Israeli military law, which applies in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, children are actually defined differently from Israeli children. Palestinian children are defined differently from Israeli children. So if you're a Palestinian and you're aged 15, 16, 17, you're actually considered as an adult under Israeli military law in terms of sentencing and the way you're actually treated in prison. So it's one example of the apartheid character of Israel's military occupation, where you have two people on the same area, but differential and discriminatory laws apply. So there are children as young as 12 who have been picked up and held under by the Israeli military and held in atrocious conditions, facing torture and beatings and separated from their families for long periods of time.
What is the gender breakdown among the prisoners?
There are currently around 100 Palestinian women, including girls, in Israeli detention, and the rest are male.
Now, the figures you gave, 11,000, and we think about that as being consistent since the occupation, that must add up to a huge proportion over time of the Palestinian population.
Absolutely. There are figures that say around 650,000 Palestinians have been arrested since the occupation began in 67. Many of those prisoners, or just about every Palestinian family, has had someone in prison or in detention at some point. So it's very common. If you go to the West Bank or Gaza Strip, everyone knows someone who is in prison, or they themselves have been in prison themselves. So it's a very common experience. It's very much a part of living under occupation. And it's really, in many ways, particularly for young Palestinian men, it's a rite of passage where you're picked up by the military at some point, arbitrarily, and either detained, or put in prison for a longer period of time.
And do people go through processes where they're charged and then they go to a court and they get given a sentence? Is that the process?
Yeah, that's a good question, because what exists in the West Bank and Gaza Strip are not normal civil courts. Again, for Palestinians, if you're arrested, you are taken before a military court. So you basically have a situation where the person arresting you is a Israeli military personnel. You're charged under military law, and you're taken before a military court where the judge is also part of the army. So if you're a Palestinian, you're taken through these military courts where there's virtually no due process. There are also 1,000 Palestinians who are held under what's called administrative detention, which means that they are held without charge or trial, and they can be held for up to 6 months at any one time, without being charged or actually going before a court to face a trial. And at the end of that 6 month period, that can be renewed. So there are Palestinians who have been in administrative detention for 6 years and longer, with their detention order renewed every 6 months. So there are around 1,000 Palestinians under administrative detention as well.
So this is kind of like the security certificates here in Canada, or like Guantanamo Bay?
Yes, exactly. It's exactly the same kind of thing, although the number of Palestinians placed under administrative detention is much larger, and the actual access to families and lawyers and any kind of due process is much worse in the case of Palestinians.
Now, you mentioned that the children as young as 12 have been arrested, and I understand that there was a case this week of a 12-year-old boy and a 13-year-old boy. Can you tell us a little bit about their case?
Yeah, this is not an uncommon thing where Palestinian children are picked up. And again, this is something that has happened since the beginning of the occupation in 1967. Palestinian children are taken by the military. They're detained away from their families, which is it's a deliberate thing. It's an attempt to break up the fabric of Palestinian society by separating young people from their society, from their neighborhoods, from their communities. And in many cases, it's important to point out that these political prisoners, they're not they're being arrested, or they're being charged with relatively innocuous crimes. It might be something like throwing a stone at a soldier, or participating in the demonstration. As I said earlier, Israeli military law that applies to Palestinians in these areas It's very broad. It can include a 10-year sentence for participating in meetings or going to a demonstration or throwing stones. So what this law is aimed at achieving is picking up as many people as possible, passing them through this system with an aim of breaking the spirit of the people, breaking the ability of the people to actually resist occupation. And also, and this is a very horrific part of the prison system, the aim is to recruit collaborators, so people who will work with the Israeli military in the Palestinian areas. And in the case of children, this is particularly horrific. In many cases, children will be picked up, they will be beaten, they'll be threatened. There are many cases of children who have been told while they're in detention, if you don't work with us, then we will arrest your family members, or we'll rape your mother or sisters, this type of threats, with the aim of actually recruiting people to work with the military. And this is, you know, obviously a horrific thing for someone who's 12 or 13 years old. So that type of practice is a very common feature of the experience of Palestinians under occupation.
Now, you said earlier that it was a rite of passage, and I'm thinking it must also work in the opposite way. At the same time that they are able to recruit collaborators, they must also be some kind of process of politicization that happens within the prisons.
Yes, that's very true. And Palestinian prisoners are very much part of the struggle of the Palestinian people and part of the Palestinian political movement. And prisoners in prisons are organized. They resist during their incarceration. There are very frequent cases of hunger strikes that will take place. There is a very strict kind of discipline that prisoners try and organize and among themselves in order to maintain themselves as a body and as a political body. This is not uncommon to just Palestinians. It's something that all political prisoners around the world have experienced and organized in this way. But it's true that many people go through prison and through that experience learn politics, learn organizing, and are trained in that way. And this is one way that Palestinians try and, or it's a very important part of breaking the experience that imprisonment can actually have on the person itself. So those Palestinians who have been through that experience and have managed to survive it do come out with very strong bonds of solidarity and very much part of the political movement.
How does the release of political prisoners figure in Israeli negotiations with Palestinians?
That's a very good question. It's quite clear that what Israel does, and this is not any kind of conspiracy, they openly say this, is that Palestinian prisoners are bargaining chips. So they will go in often before negotiations or a period of negotiations and do a sweep of an area, pick up many prisoners, and say, well, we're not going to release people unless you agree to this, or you lower your political demands, or you basically do what we want you to do to the Palestinian negotiators. So in this way, they're bargaining chips or hostages used to reward or cajole negotiators. And that's historically been the case, and it's very, very much, it's very clear in the recent period that Palestinians are used in this way. So it's something, though, that it's every Palestinian political party and movement is very clear that there can never be any agreement, any kind of peace agreement, without the release of all Palestinian political prisoners.
What kind of popular support is there for the release of political prisoners? You mentioned the parties have made it clear, but on the popular level,
it's a very important part of the solidarity movement with prisoners. So outside, within the cities and the towns and the villages, families of prisoners are very active. They will regularly organize demonstrations, calling on Palestinian leaders not to forget the prisoners and to keep those demands high in any kind of political struggle. They'll also frequently conduct sit-ins or hunger strikes, set up tents and do solidarity hunger strikes during periods where there are struggles inside the prisons. So if there's a hunger strike in the prison, there'll be very often a solidarity hunger strike within the Palestinian areas in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, in towns and villages. Another key focus of these demonstrations are the United Nations and different UN compounds, because one of the key issues facing families of prisoners is their inability to actually visit their relatives in prisons. Because what happens if someone is arrested in the West Bank or Gaza Strip by the Israeli military, they are taken to a prison or detention center that is outside of those areas, inside outside of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And this is in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, where people are not supposed to be taken out of the occupied areas. And it also means that families are unable to visit their relatives who are in prison. They're unable to get permits. So there'll frequently be demonstrations by families outside of the UN, different UN facilities, demanding that the UN take, and the Red Cross, take a stronger position and insist that families are given the ability to actually visit their relatives in prison.
Well, thanks very much for all that information, Adam, and we'll be pointing people towards the conference that you're going to be speaking at next Saturday.
Great. Thank you very much, Jen. It's a pleasure.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Lushmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Lumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Najee Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.